Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up in the push to ban cell phones from schools, are we forgetting about what kids will do in an emergency? And from melting pumpkins to failed fall gardens, how this record October heat is changing all of our lives. But first, this morning, we are less than a month away from the November election, and Arizonans are about to get bombarded by campaign visits. Kamala Harris is rallying in Phoenix on Thursday. Donald Trump will be in Prescott Valley on Sunday. Today, we have both vice presidential candidates crisscrossing the state. First Lady Jill Biden is heading to Yuma Friday. And House Majority Leader Steve Scalise was here yesterday stumping for Trump. Woo. That was a lot. Okay, so all of this points to what else? The fact that Arizona is central to either candidate winning this presidential election. So they're all here this week as we kick off early voting today. But we have to ask, what is the point of all of these visits? At this point in this neck-and-neck race, who are they trying to convince? Here to shed some light is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from our politics desk. Good morning there, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with that central question, right? Like, who are the candidates trying to convince with these big rallies? Like, I can't imagine a lot of undecided voters are heading to Prescott Valley or to Phoenix to rally for either of these candidates.
No, but I'll be in Prescott Valley because it sounds fun to me. I think that it's kind of a blitz, you know, doing anything and everything that you can when early voting starts in a swing state to get face time, to show that you care, to rally people to get up and vote. Because I think a lot of undecided voters are people who are undecided about whether to vote at all. You know, people who are maybe disenfranchised, who don't like either of the candidates, who just think they're going to stay home. And this is, I think, doing anything and everything to convince those people to at least go out and vote.
Right, right. So you're rallying the faithful in some ways, but also kind of hoping that the message that you're here gets out to everybody else who's not at those rallies.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in some ways, I think a rally is almost always going to be an echo chamber, preaching to the choir, preaching to the faithful, because it's, you know, like a Trump rally, for example. Mm-hmm. You know who's going to be there. It's all the Trump supporters, the loyalists, the other Republican candidates who are of the same ilk and the people who support them. So It's going to be a lot of the same people who have gone to, you know, a million Trump rallies before. But you have to do it. And in the hopes of other people being there. Plus, they're not just doing rallies. I mean, they're also doing ads and stuff. And, you know, not just touring Arizona, but other states that are nearby. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the only thing they can do.
It's kind of the only thing they can do. And they're doing a lot of it. So I wonder, does it matter where the candidates go? Like, obviously, in Arizona is an important place to be. We're a big swing state this time around. But going to Prescott Valley versus going to Phoenix versus going to Tucson or Yuma, like, do the places matter in terms of who they're targeting?
Yes, because you have to assume that the person who goes to Prescott Valley isn't also going to zigzag around to Tucson, Yuma, and Phoenix. And so you're getting more of a spread of voters. You don't just want to show up in the Valley time and time again, even though that's convenient. Of course, the border has its own connotation. The candidates going down to the border is sort of a cliche in Arizona, yeah. Right? It's like, here I am caring about border security, but they've both done it, and I think it's necessary for them to do that, to show up in southern Arizona and court that vote specifically.
Yeah. So are we talking at this point in the race, Cameron, about turning out the vote, about getting the people who are going to vote for you to actually fill out that ballot, which are going out today?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also like a reminder for people who maybe don't know the exact day that early voting starts, which, fun fact, it's today, is that you can go out and vote starting right now. And I assume this is not going to be the last visit for any of them. I assume this is going to be something that they hammer in for the next few weeks.
Get ready for traffic. Okay. So I want to ask about undecided voters and how candidates can reach them at this point. First of all, like, really, at this point, how many undecided voters are there? What are the polls telling us?
Not a lot. There was a AARP poll that came out, I believe, yesterday that says that it's a tight race, Trump's up slightly, but that also the number of undecided voters is a fraction. It's like 3% maybe for the presidential race. Mm. And obviously it depends on which race we're talking about. But I think at this point, people have had a lot of time to make up their minds. Obviously, we know anything and everything about Trump because he's been in the arena for how many years now, right? And we know a lot about Harris. So people, if they want to pay attention, there's like a million resources they can look at. But undecided voters could be, they're kind of a mystery. They're not always independents. Mm-hmm. That's a common misconception, right? They could be people on the left. They could be people on the right. They could be people in the Green Party, Libertarian Party. They could have some sort of affiliation, but have some other reason for being undecided. Or it could be, you know, they're undecided because of the candidate's opinions on a particular issue, and you can't know exactly which issue that is. So you just have to hope that you're reaching them.
They're really covering the gamut. Mm-hmm. Polls show, and have been for the last week or so, maybe a little bit more, Trump slightly ahead in Arizona at this point. Are those polls moving at all, or are they starting to really lock in?
I think the polls showing that Trump is up like that are a movement from when Harris first announced, and there was this huge swell of enthusiasm from the Democrats and some of the independents who were more excited to vote for her than Biden, and we saw that talking to voters. And now that sort of died out, and people have gotten used to her as a candidate. So I think Trump, you know, coming back slightly ahead is the end of that. But you never know. It's still tight. It's still a tight race.
And we're going to expect it to be tight on Election Day. As we said, early voting is kicking off here today. That's most voters getting those ballots in the mail soon. Should we expect people to fill out those quickly? Do they hang on to them for a long time? Are there trends we should be watching there?
I think people are prone to procrastinating, but yes, early voting is very popular. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, starting today, they are successful in getting out a good chunk. And then it probably peters out for a bit. And then there's probably a last minute, oh, God, I haven't sent in my ballot yet. And then another swell. And then Election Day itself. So it's kind of like a up, down, up, stop.
All right. We'll be watching for it all. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
There was a time in American politics when a candidate's religion was central to their campaigns. JFK was the first Catholic president of this country. For Ronald Reagan, his Christianity was important to his message. George W. Bush spoke passionately about being born again. Barack Obama drew heavily from the Black Church. But this election cycle, the religious beliefs of the major candidates are not front and center. Donald Trump went into the White House as a Presbyterian, but changed his religion to non-denominational Christianity while in office. He has won over the vote of most evangelicals, but most Americans don't think he has strong religious beliefs. Kamala Harris also doesn't talk a whole lot about her faith. But when she got the call from President Biden to tell her he was dropping out of the presidential race, one of the first calls she made was to her pastor, according to Mississippi Today. Her religious experience has always been interfaith. She grew up in the Bay Area, going to both a Black Baptist church and a Hindu temple. She is married to a Jewish man. Though you might not know it, by all accounts, Harris is a woman of faith. And our next guest argues she should talk about it more. Jessica Gross is an opinion columnist for the New York Times, and I spoke with her more about it.
So she was raised Baptist, but her mother was Hindu. So she was raised in sort of an interfaith tradition. She did go to church as a child in Oakland, and then she has a very strong connection with her pastor in San Francisco. Mm. And she went to a historically Black college where there's a lot of interaction with the Black church. So it's clearly been something that's an important force in her life. And I started this piece sort of interested in her because she is also in an interfaith marriage, as am I. She is married to a Jewish man. And so I wanted to sort of see the role that faith played both in her political life and her personal life.
So when she has talked about faith, how does she talk about it? Does she talk about it in terms of something personal, in terms of her policies, in terms of the government?
So she doesn't talk about it a lot, but when she has talked about it, she ties it to her policy beliefs. She talks about healthcare, she talks about abortion, and she talks about it through the lens of her personal faith, which I found really interesting. And I think it's something that she should do more often, not in a mercenary way, not in a way just to get votes, but because it seems quite genuine. And I think it will appeal to people who might not feel that they know that much about her personally. By her talking about this really deep-seated faith that she's had since she was a child, it could make a lot of people feel like they really knew her in a deeper way.
That's interesting. Why is it that you think she doesn't talk about religion that much? I mean, this is kind of political, but also at the same time, you don't hear Donald Trump talk about religion that much either.
Right. Well, you know, Donald Trump talks about religion when he is talking to largely evangelical or conservative Christian audiences. He doesn't talk about his personal faith, but he talks about it like, I love Christians so much and I'm going to do everything for you and get you everything you want. So while he doesn't talk about it from a personal lens, because, you know, by all indications, church going has never been a big part of his life, I think she doesn't talk about it for two reasons. One, she is a very reserved person. You know, she doesn't seem to want to talk about really any aspects of her personal life. But I think it's also because it's a little tricky as a Democrat to talk about faith. A huge portion of their voters are fully secular. They're atheists, they're agnostic, they have no religion in particular. I think the statistic I saw was 45% of Joe Biden's voters fell into that category.
Wow, yeah.
And so there's this way in which I think talking about religion has become coded as conservative, when really it shouldn't be. There are so many people of faith who have all different kinds of political beliefs, and it really doesn't have anything to do on its face with one's personal relationship with God, with one's personal relationship with their church or temple or mosque. They don't have to be so tied together, even though they have become sort of tied together in pop culture.
Well, I mean, it comes at such an interesting moment in which, and you've written about this, about we're sort of losing our religion in this country, but especially for those on the left. You're arguing that she should talk about this more, that it not only gives people a glimpse into her true self, her personal life, but you think that she has a chance to change that overarching narrative in politics, that religion is only for conservatives.
I think that's right. I mean, I was actually blown away talking to an expert, Ryan Burge, who is both a pastor and a political scientist. And he asked me who I thought was the president who had gone to church most frequently when he was in office. Mm. And my guess was George W. Bush, because, you know, we think of him as the compassionate conservative. He talked about his evangelicalism a lot. But the answer is actually Joe Biden.
Interesting.
And Joe Biden, if you, you know, read about it, he is a very serious Catholic. He goes to church a lot. It is really an important part of his life, but he doesn't really get credit for it from voters or from the public. Not that someone should get credit. That's such a weird way to, but he doesn't. I mean, we don't think of him, I think, as a really religious person. And again, I think it is because religion has been so coded as a conservative thing. And I think that there's a way to talk about your own personal beliefs and things that mean a lot to you without alienating people who don't agree with you or don't have those beliefs. I think there's a way that you can talk about religion in a way that's really inclusive and shows your heart and isn't about, you know, rejecting and exclusion and saying you're not on our team. And I think she really has an opportunity to do that.
How does something as important this election cycle as abortion play into this? Like, Harris often says that one does not have to abandon their faith or deeply held religious beliefs to agree that a woman should have the ability to make decisions about her own body, right? Like, that is an argument for abortion rights, but from a maybe sort of religious perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously tricky. Different faith traditions have really different views on this. I mean, I'm Jewish, I'm a Reformed Jew. I think our denomination is probably like the most supportive of abortion rights for women, and there's a real sort of religious argument for it from Reformed Jews. So, you know, different religious traditions have different ideas about what abortion means. But obviously, a lot of white Protestants and white Catholics especially think that abortion is murder. It's wrong. It is morally wrong. It is morally awful. And we should do everything in our power to stop it. And, you know, I respect that. I understand where that's coming from. But I think we all need to understand that that's not the only way to think about the issue from a religious point of view. And I think that they've been really successful in framing it as the only appropriate religious point of view on this issue, when that doesn't really need to be the case. And so she is a, you know, Black Protestant. They are largely supportive of abortion rights, at least people who identify as Black Protestants. So it's not really going to alienate the people who share her beliefs for her to say, you know, my faith informs my feeling about this issue.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jessica Gross, opinion columnist for the New York Times, joining us. Jessica, thanks as always. Appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll hear from a National Geographic ocean photographer.
Yeah, you know, I like to say there's this thin blue line that separates people from the ocean. I mean, without storytellers, without photographers and filmmakers, no one would even know what's happening.
He says the more time he spent in the water, the more he's seen it change. But first, back in 2016, before she started traveling the country reporting on the Latino community for outlets like Vice and MSNBC, Paola Ramos worked on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And in the aftermath of Clinton's defeat, Ramos realized the campaign had made a grave mistake. They'd assumed that Latino voters would find Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric repulsive and that they would support Clinton in droves. Instead, a surprisingly large percentage of Latinos voted for Trump. Since then, his share of the Latino vote has increased. According to a recent NBC News poll, Latino support for Trump has more than doubled since 2016. In her new book, Defectors, Ramos sets out to understand what she calls the rightward drift of Latinos in America. The book unfolds as a series of character studies from which Ramos extrapolates the broader cultural factors that explain Trump's growing appeal. Early in the book, she introduces us to Anthony Aguero. Aguero is a self-proclaimed independent reporter who drives up and down the border, filming migrants and refugees attempting to enter the United States. He frames his work as an attempt to document the existential threat to America. And as Ramos told the show's Sam Dingman, Aguero's story illustrates the complexities and contradictions of modern Latino identity.
So much of our conversation was driven by Anthony just making sure that I understood, that he was part of this quote unquote like American life, and that those asylum seekers and those I'm putting in quotations, that wasn't him,
Right.
And this sort of us versus them rhetoric is so much of who Anthony is.
Right. And this is a big part of building tribalism. It seems like it being a part of the quote-unquote American tribe, as opposed to whatever the other tribe would be, is really important to him.
Exactly. And I think part of what I try and do in the book is to force us to understand where these sort of racial and ethnic grievances come from. I think so much of our history as Latinos obviously starts with the weight of colonization in Latin America, right? And the way that the Spanish colonizers really institutionalized these hierarchies. And in the United States, I think when you have a Donald Trump who's really fixated in creating the who's part of the in-group and who's the out-group, that can be pretty powerful for some Latinos.
To that end, I wanted to ask you about, for me, one of the most moving moments in the sequence where you are talking to Anthony. It's towards the end of that section, and you do this thing that you actually do several times in the book to great effect, I think, where you just ask him this really direct emotional question. You say, does it get lonely? Referring to the amount of time he spends driving around looking for migrants to film. And he tells you that he spends a lot of time when he is driving around like this with the radio off, just kind of riding in silence and thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oftentimes what I've found with these characters is that everyone is kind of in their own journey to find belonging. I think Anthony Aguero is someone that I think is painfully trying to really, get Republicans to feel like Anthony is one of them.
Right. Yeah. It's such a powerful moment. He says to you, I think, if memory serves, he says, I know people think I'm weird.
Yes.
And then he doesn't say anything else, but the reader is kind of left to reach the conclusion that he's just so desperate for what he's doing to make him not weird to somebody.
That's exactly. When you have the option to identify with what you see as superior, you take it.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the story of Isabel, another one of your principal characters. Tell us who she is.
Isabel is Afro-Dominican. She's a Trump supporter. She owns a hair salon in the Bronx. And so I think initially when you tell folks that, Donald Trump performed really well in the Bronx, or that Donald Trump even dared to go to the Bronx during, his campaign stopped a couple of months ago. I think a lot of people laughed. But when you actually look at the numbers in the Bronx, where Isabel lives, Donald Trump made significant inroads there in 2020 compared to 2016 in the state of New York. Like, that is where he actually started to perform pretty well. And it makes no sense at first, right? Because we're talking about a population like Isabel that are Afro-Latino. My conversation with Isabel was really revealing, because what she explained to me is that one of the reasons why she really liked Trump was really around the way that Donald Trump made her feel safe vis-a-vis Black people in America and vis-a-vis African Americans in America. It made her feel that if he were to be elected again, she would not feel as threatened by them. She saw herself as an Afro-Latina, very racially different than African Americans in this country.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons that she's such a fascinating character in the story, because, and this is quoting from the book, you say, Isabel may just be an ordinary Dominican in her home country, but here white people will see Isabel as a Black woman. And that immediately puts a target on her back. American culture will put her in a box, label her, and create a story about who she is before Isabel is able to tell her own story. And even in just hearing you give that description of her, it seems like, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding, Trump is kind of creating this warped permission structure for somebody like Isabel to say, you can be an Afro-Latina woman and you should be a Republican because I'm the one who's in this weird way recognizing who you are and saying that Blackness isn't that, which is how many other people see you. It's very messy, yeah. But it makes a weird kind of sense.
I wouldn't give Trump that much credit.
Sure.
Or Republicans that much credit. What I do know and what I do see is that they have understood, and that's why they ran with this during the 2022 midterms, right? The crime fear-mongering, and which has now morphed into the migrant fear-mongering, like that tactic, criminalizing Black people, and now they're criminalizing immigrants. That works. There's a reason why they were really, really spreading that message in places like the Bronx and really across New York among Afro-Latino communities, because they knew that that fear could resonate with a lot of Afro-Latinos, you know, the sort of otherizing of Black people, which, again, it's an old political trope, you know?
Right. So it's almost like they're saying, come over to our side and we will protect you from the forces people think you are or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And someone, to bring it back to Isabel, she would always refer to Black people as them, no? Sort of when she talked about what are the top issues in your mind. And she would often say, you know, protecting myself from them. And when I asked her, who do you mean by them? She meant, in her own words, I'm quoting her, los morenos, no? And los morenos, and essentially saying it's Black people in America.
So to close, Paola, there has been this very fundamental misunderstanding on the left, it sounds like, about how the loyalties of Latinos in America are really taking shape and what the actual motivating factors are. What is your hope for the outcome of publishing a book like this? Like, what do you think are the stakes of this continued rightward drift, as you put it?
So much of what this whole system is built on and what Democratic politics is built on is this idea that Latinos would be at the heart of the Democrat sort of multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition. If you believe that Donald Trump is a threat, if you are sort of counting on Latinos to sort of counter the effects of Trumpism and the perceived danger of Trumpism, that you need to understand what's going on with the Latino community. And those answers don't come in political language. Those answers entail very uncomfortable conversations like the one that you and I are having, right? Because it's talking about racism, it's talking about colorism, it's talking about history, and it's talking about political trauma. And so I think everyone needs to take the time and the care and be intentional about having curiosity around that defection. I think it's important.
Well, Paola Ramos is a contributor for Telemundo News and MSNBC and the author of Defectors. You can see her speak about this reporting in person at Changing Hands Bookstore tonight. Paola, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Lots of school districts around the country are implementing new rules about students' cell phones, specifically trying to make sure students aren't using them during the school day. They cite reduced distractions as a main reason they want students to put their phones away. But some parents who want to make sure their kids do have access to their phones, at least in some circumstances. And last month's shooting at a Georgia high school reinforced one of their main arguments. Wellington Suarez has written about this. He's a reporter for the nonprofit Chalkbeat. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with whether there's a unified argument that parents and parents groups with whom he spoke made about why kids should have access to their phones in school.
Yes, of course. So my piece started with a survey from the National Parents Union that was released a couple weeks ago. And in that survey that he did with parents, they identified that around 78% of the parents whose children already bring phones to school, they do that. They send their kids with their phones for emergency communication. So they are worried that if something happens during the school day, they will not be able to reach their kids if they don't have the phone in their hands, which is a very valid concern. Many parents that I spoke to actually mentioned school shootings as one of the reasons that they are worried. But there are also other concerns like health. You have students that have diabetes, for instance, that have devices connected to their bodies that will send information to their phones, and the parents want to be able to check in with the kids. There are kids who have mental health situations that also sometimes would like to be able to reach out to the parents if something happens during the school day. So this is the biggest concern the parents have around kids not being able to have access to their phone during the school day. But it's important also to say that parents agree that cell phones can be a distraction and can be harmful for learning. So in that sense, they are very aligned with the opinion of professors, teachers, and with those arguments that are pro the cell phone bans.
It's interesting because while the parents might send their kids to school with phones, obviously, their kids might use their phones for other things while they're at school if they're allowed to. So I wonder, you know, what the parents had to say about, you know, maybe the balance that needs to be made here. Because as you say, they want their kids to be able to have access to their phone in case of emergency, but they also understand why the schools are telling kids to put their phones away or turn them off, things like that.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I think most of the parents, they are concerned with the most restrictive policies. So there are some policies that claim that students would have to put their phones in a pouch that's locked during the school day, or they will have to hand in their phones. And this is when parents are a little more concerned. They are usually, at least the parents that I talk to, they are okay if the policy says that the cell phone has to be in the backpack, or that the cell phone has to be, you know, like away, kept away during instruction hours. They are also okay with trying to find other compromises, like kids having access to their smartwatches instead of their phones, or using apps that allow kids, that parents can control what kids are doing during the school hours, so that they can block kids from using other apps or social media or texting their friends, but still being able to contact family and emergency services.
So depending on the age of students, so many kids in schools now are on computers or tablets or other kinds of devices. Does it seem as though there might be a solution there where parents might be able to communicate with their kids through their device, either school issued or, you know, if the student owns it themselves, the family owns it themselves, might that be a potential solution here?
To be honest, the specialist that I talked to didn't really go on that specific topic. Well, a lot of schools now have Chromebooks or laptops that are owned by the schools. Ideally, those are only used during class hours. So it wouldn't be ideal that kids were communicating with their parents or anyone during this time. What schools say is that they have the tools that kids can use if they have in a specific need. So what most of the specialists say, or the experts say, is that there are already some other alternatives that parents can use. And one thing that especially one person that I talked to, which is an expert on safety, said is that the idea that phones bring security, it's more of an emotional security for the parents, because the actual security is supposed to be already working well in schools with the policies that schools already have to reaching out to parents, or school safety policies. So it's much more an emotional thing that parents are looking for here. So there's not a lot that schools seem to be very eager to negotiate in that sense.
Well, I was going to ask you what you heard from schools or district officials or school officials about, you know, what the parents are saying and what potential changes schools might be looking to make. It sounds like, at least for some schools, they're not really looking to make many changes at all.
Yeah, there's the poll from the National Parents Union actually pointed that 70% of parents felt that they were not consulted when the cell phone policies were put into place. There is a number of alternatives and compromises that can be made, and it would be very important that parents and students are consulted. What experts say in terms of the safety, and more specifically about school shootings or active shooter situations, is that cell phones don't really help in the situations. Actually, one of the experts I interviewed said that they can be harmful, because if you have an emergency situation and kids need to be quiet or need to follow instructions, being on their phone actually can distract them from following the instructions that are given, or make noises that can be a problem in that type of situation. So in that sense, they are not super flexible, and they don't really see that the parents' concern will actually mean an improvement. However, it's still parents' right to feel the need to have that emotional contact and that emotional security. One of the parents that I talked to, she had her two children go through active shooter situations. And in both of them, her children texted her and she said, even though I know that there's nothing that I can do at that moment, I just wanted to have the opportunity to say them that I love them, mm-hmm. and to let them know that I'm here. Probably if schools are able to hear parents, as I said, 70% of parents say that they were not consulted. So if they're able to sit together and discuss it, I'm pretty sure that they will find some compromises, either using apps that can be controlled by parents, or finding policies that are not super restrictive, like, oh, all phones have to be on the backpacks, or all phones have to be turned off, but the kids can still hold them, or something like that. But it really depends on having this availability from parents and from schools to sit down together and talk about it.
All right. That is Wellington Suarez, reporter with Chalkbeat. Wellington, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We broke yet another heat record in the valley over the weekend as thermometers tallied 113 degrees at Sky Harbor International Airport. But it is October. October, that time we're supposed to be buying pumpkins and putting up Halloween decorations, drinking pumpkin spice, and maybe, just maybe, putting on a sweater. Now, we here at the show know this is Phoenix, and it's hot here, but after another record-breaking summer of heat, this hot autumn is pushing some of us over the edge. And here to talk about it is our own executive producer, Amy Silverman. She's also a columnist for Phoenix Magazine and a longtime Arizona journalist. Hi there, Amy.
Hey, Lauren.
Okay, so I know you've lived here your entire life. We know it can get hot in Phoenix in the summer. We know it can often stay hot until Halloween. That's always like my cutoff. I think Halloween will be the first time it almost feels chilly outside. But this is not normal, right?
Right. I always say it's a little bit warm until Halloween, and then you got to put a sweater over your costume, which always bums everybody out. But now I don't know if we'll ever have sweater weather here again. And for me, fall has always been like spring is for everybody else all over the country. I get depressed in March thinking about the summer, and all I do is look forward to September. And now I'm starting to think maybe I'll need to start looking forward to October instead, because September's just really another summer month.
Another summer month. Okay. And I want to talk about the way it kind of changes our lives in all of these little ways. Like, there are big ways if you're not as lucky as we are and you're not living in a home with good air conditioning. But for me, it's in parenting. Like, it's not being able to let my kids go outside now for months on end. It's how my kids' fall soccer league, fall in quotes there, had to cancel games due to extreme heat. They've moved them to night games. Where do you notice it most, Amy?
We might need to move to the biosphere, right? It really is so different this year. And I've tried for so long to tell myself, it's not that bad. There are other cities that are hot. Phoenix has always been hot. But now that it's hit October, it's really different. And I've always felt like when we get to the point where the mornings and the evenings cool off, mm-hmm. I can deal with it. I can deal with the middle of the day. But now you go outside and it's 90 degrees at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're really in trouble because the thermometer's coming for Halloween. So we might as well just keep this whole summer-ween trend with, like, I don't know, what are they, carving watermelons into jack-o'-lanterns. I'm really bitter because one of my best friends years ago made me a candy corn wreath where she took one of those styrofoam wreaths and glued individual pieces of candy corn all over, hundreds of them, and then shellacked it with glitter. And if you put it up now, you would come home and half the candy corn would be melted onto the porch.
That's entirely true. Yeah.
So we're just not getting Halloween at all.
Yeah. You can't put out pumpkins yet. We put ours inside because if you put them outside, they're going to completely melt.
They're going to rot instantly. And yeah, you're going to talk your kids into walking outside in a costume at 5 p.m.
So I know also, like, we both, you know, try to be gardeners here in Phoenix. I haven't even started mine yet because it doesn't seem useful. What about yours?
It's so sad. I don't need to put Halloween decorations up because it's terrifying in my garden right now. You just need to go out there. Everything's dead. I haven't even bothered to pull it up. I tried to grow pumpkins this year, and that was a pathetic attempt. And now everything's all crunchy and scary. And mm-hmm. I keep telling myself when it gets under 100, I'll think about starting a fall garden, but I don't think we're going to have time.
When it gets under 100, yeah. Okay, so it seems as if this will be our quote-unquote, like, new normal, that phrase we've heard a lot of. So I asked an expert to make sure I was right about this, and ASU's Randy Cervini told me that they measure quote-unquote normal in weather based on the 30-year period up to the last year ending in zero, which I did not know and I found very interesting. So that means we measure normal in weather now based on the averages from 1991 to 2020. And he told me, yes, for most cities around the world, particularly Phoenix, the official weather normals have gone up over the last several decades, not just the last few years, like it really seems to us. So if we know these kind of normals are going up, what do you think this means, Amy, for the future and what it might be like to live here in the future?
Well, I think to put it poetically, we're screwed, right? I mean, it's not going to make the place uninhabitable. And that's kind of a silly discussion to have. It's not going to be on fire anytime soon. But it really is starting to impact our day-to-day lives. And it's more serious than my candy corn wreath melting, of course. I mean, what about people's electric bills, right? We budget so that we can pay high air conditioning bills through the summer. And now if September and October are also those months, that's really going to mess with people financially. And, you know, I'm seeing signs up saying that the cooling centers are open longer. We wouldn't have thought, I mean, last year, 2 years ago, we wouldn't have thought that that would be the case. In fact, even last year, October wasn't super hot.
No, no. Okay, so we have to end with maybe a positive note. Okay, so on the flip side, fall has always looked different to us in the Sonoran Desert, and that's not out of the ordinary, right? Is there something good in this? Like, can we find a silver lining and look at this in a way that is unique?
Okay, so one thing I've been trying for years is to introduced the concept of winter linen, which basically means wearing linen all year long because we already have so much for the summer. And so for the last few winters, I have shivered in my linen. And now I think maybe winter linen will have to be a thing. But I don't know that is that really a silver lining, or does that just make you sad about your sweaters?
I miss my sweaters, but this is another alternative, at least.
It is. And you know, so when I lived on the East Coast for a few years, for a blip in my 20s, many decades ago. And when I came back, I noticed that there were these bonkers holiday displays of lights. And someone explained that it's because we don't have the trappings of Christmas and wintertime here in the valley, right? We don't have the snow and the fires and all of that. And so instead, people just go to town with their lights. So I guess maybe that's a silver lining if you enjoy driving around and looking at the what they like coordinate them to the radio and
oh, yeah.
and all of that. and they do that for Halloween too. Mm-hmm. So maybe we just need to stay in our cars with our air conditioning on year round and drive around and look at lights.
See all those Halloween lights. We're putting some up today. All right. That is our own executive producer, Amy Silverman. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The world's oceans are full of life and interesting species, but they're also threatened and in some ways misunderstood. Our next guest tries to bridge that gap between understanding what's happening under the water and making sure it can continue. Andy Mann is an ocean conservationist and a photographer and filmmaker for National Geographic magazine. He'll be speaking tonight at Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live series. His talk is called From Summit to Sea. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with Mann and started the conversation by asking what about the oceans interests him.
I grew up in the Chesapeake Bay of Virginia, so I always had a love for the water. And the more time I spent in the water, the more I saw it change. I've always had a passion for photography and filmmaking. So when I combined the two, I found purpose in my work, and that's the path I've been on.
What kinds of changes have you noticed?
I've noticed a lot of changes. I've seen our coral reefs start to deplete. I've seen fish abundance and biodiversity go down in the 15 years that I've been diving. And I've seen the conversations and community engagement go up. So we're at a very critical time right now for our oceans.
What are those conversations like? Like when you speak with people or just, you know, have events like what you're going to be having here in Mesa, what are the conversations like about what's going on in our oceans and seas and what needs to happen?
Yeah, you know, I like to say there's this thin blue line that separates people from the ocean. I mean, without storytellers, without photographers and filmmakers, no one would even know what's happening out in the open ocean. You know, we think it's this endless, abundant resource, but it's not. It's delicate and very fragile. And my job is to give a voice to the voiceless. These animals, they don't have a voice. And so it's my job to bring their stories to people and start these conversations. And those conversations range anything from like, oh my gosh, I had no idea how beautiful the species was, to, wow, I see the impact story you're telling. What can I do to be involved?
What worries you the most about what you've been seeing?
I think the greatest threat our oceans face is apathy. You know, like I said, these animals, they don't have a voice, you know, and it's my job to bring those stories to people and to engage people, to bring whatever is in their basket, whatever they do, you know, bring it to the environmental movement, because we just need as many ambassadors as we can get.
What is it like for you to do the diving and do the kind of underwater photography you do?
My work is so thrilling, Mark. It changes. No 2 days are ever the same. There's some days I go out on the boat and we're searching all day for whales or sharks or fish or whatever the natural history subject is we're trying to film. And then there's some days where it's just, you know, the magic of the oceans unlock and you're the only person in the water in this like incredible event. And, you know, every day is different and you just can expect the unexpected out there.
Well, how do you try to deal with that? Because obviously you're trying to tell the story of what is actually happening under the water. But I would imagine when you go in there, you kind of have a sense, at least to some extent, of what you might expect.
Yeah, totally. And it's all perspective. I mean, like you could dive a healthy coral reef, like 1 square meter of coral reef. And if it's healthy, you'll never see all the life that's in that 1 square meter.
Hmm.
You know, so, you know, you have to make a choice when you get in the water as a filmmaker. Do you want to put on a macro lens and focus on the tiniest little subjects? Because they're incredibly valuable and as interesting and charismatic as the large megafauna. Or do you want to put on a wide angle lens and sort of tell that bigger, wider story of some of the bigger, what I like to call charismatic megafauna, those whales and sharks and things that people really do connect to. So you make the choice, you stick with it, you go down, you learn, you get inspired, and you try to make as many wonderful images as you can.
Have you had instances where you have been filming something and it really, really has not gone the way that you've expected? And I don't know if you've been in dangerous situations or just something has kind of gone awry that you kind of had to think on the fly, oh my gosh, what am I going to do here?
There has been those situations. Yeah. You know, you can find yourself, you know, in just ripping current, unexpected ripping current, you know, where it's almost impossible to film or even have a safe dive. There's other divers in the water. You know, for me, I'm hyper-focused on my environment, trying to chase a shot. And there's oftentimes I'm with another group of divers that doesn't have the same attention to detail. So I'm always looking around me to make sure I can see everybody, that our group is together. And, you know, like big, large sharks, whales, these animals are really unpredictable. And so you got to think on your feet. But, you know, that's sort of like an intuition you get after all these years.
I would think, because some of those animals are really, really big and really, really heavy. And I would think you would want to sort of, for lack of a better word, stay on their good side or stay out of their way.
It's true. Yeah, I have this thing I call Kodak courage. And I don't know if it's because I have a large camera. Like, my camera is quite big. You know, it's got a big glass dome port. It's made of metal. It is heavy and large. And, you know, but I want the sharks. I want the animals to be right up inches from that dome port, because I want people to connect with the image. You know, I want them to open the pages of National Geographic and feel an emotional connection to that species, to that image. So that requires me working in close distances. But like I said, I feel safe behind the camera. I've only done a few dives in my entire career without a camera.
Okay.
And I felt so much more vulnerable than if I had one.
That's so interesting. I mean, because obviously, like, if an animal wants to get to you, a camera is not going to protect you. It's so interesting that it gives you that sense of that feeling of safety.
It does. I mean, most of these animals are misunderstood. You know, especially in these ocean environments where, like, you both have eyes on each other and that element of surprise is gone.
Yeah.
Mostly you're just working in a scenario where there's a curiosity between the animal and myself, you know? And so you're sort of doing this dance and time slows down. And I've taken so many people diving with sharks for the first time. And that sense of fear turns into a sense of excitement just immediately.
Huh. Is there anywhere that you really would love to dive and film that you haven't yet had a chance to do it?
I've been lucky to have, you know, gone diving on all seven continents. And there are a few places here and there. There's a couple, like, natural history events that happen all over the world that are incredibly rare. And so those are kind of like the things that I really strive to be lucky enough to see, like a bait ball, for instance, you know, where there's like a big group of sardines and all of a sudden it only lasts like 3 minutes, but you have hundreds of sharks, hundreds of tunas, you have thousands of birds dive bombing from the air. And then 3 minutes later, all you see is just the shimmer of sardine scales just going to the bottom. There's nothing left. And those events are really rare, but wow, you see the images from those. Yeah, I'm really jealous of anyone that's gotten to really film a big bait ball.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That is Andy Mann, an ocean conservationist. He's also a photographer and filmmaker for National Geographic magazine. He'll be speaking tonight at Mesa Art Center as part of the National Geographic Live series. Andy, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. The pleasure's mine.
All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app and you will find our monthly playlist. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.